Were any of your formative crushes cartoon characters? Are any of your current crushes cartoon characters? If so, come hither, sit and listen to our tales of similar affliction. I'm comedy writer and 42-year-old child Gabby Hutchison Crouch, and let me tell you, there's some stuff on Crunchyroll I rewatched 2 weeks later for the English dub because, to quote myself, the voices are hotter. Let your sexy-voiced American actors join a sexy-voiced union, Crunchyroll! I want to find out what, besides their sexy voices, is so appealing, with help from some funny guests who are here for a chat about the animated characters that make them jump clean out of their trousers and then very slowly float back down to the floor, surrounded by all cherubs and that. Will we find something out about early crushes, pop culture and sexuality, or will we just talk about sexy voices? Whatever we do, I hope it'll help you see that all those drawings you did of Marge Simpson as a lesbian 1940s pin-up girl are absolutely fine. Welcome to Curiously Drawn. With me this episode is a comedy writer with credits including The MASH Report, The Lenny Henry Show, Comic Relief, Horrible Histories, Frankie Boer's World Order, and his own Radio 2 sitcom Parental Guidance. He and I did the same BBC in-house comedy writer job together in 2014, so obviously I want him to fail miserably. So I will be using this podcast as a means of chipping away at his self-esteem until he gives up. It's Max Davis. Hello, Max.
Hi, Gabby. What an absolutely delightful intro.
Yeah.
Thank you for remembering credits that I had stupidly... This is why I'm not doing better, because I was like, oh, yeah, you have done that.
What the fuck did you...
Sorry, no swear. Hi. It's so nice to be here. So nice to talk to you.
I know. So yeah, we're old office buds.
We're bursary sibs.
Bursary sibs, because we are the same age. We were very at the time. I think still we were very old to be bursary writers. We were both in our early 30s at the time, and
we were. Yeah,
we had this little...
But you had a connection to the youngness, which is that you were very, and probably still are, I imagine, I'm not on it anymore, but you had a big Twitter following, so that gave you the cool points that I didn't.
I mean, it also meant that sometimes people would be very, very angry at me and would find out that I was technically on the BBC's payroll at the time, and make out that that meant I was a BBC maniac globalist. Whatever their issue is.
It's so funny that I was talking to another one of our a bursary alum. I was talking to the brilliant writer Laura Major.
Yay.
And saying that when you and I did the bursary, I feel like we got 6 months of like when the news was still normal. And then there was that general election where the Tories got their majority back. And it felt like that was the beginning of the crazy times that we still live.
That was crazy summer. You remember that so much shit went down in the summer of 2014. That was the summer. So the Ukraine War One, Ukraine Invasion the First was very much going on, and that's when the jet was shot down. Like as we were about to do a record for the news quiz. That was when the jet got shot down. And then there were like three wars going on at the same time. There was the Ukraine invasion, Israel and Palestine kicked off again. And there was another war, like a third war. Syria kept getting like really scary. it was all just right. Like the mad, mad summer of just war. And then that was the... And then that new year, like the one time a year, Christmas, New Year, where we can usually rely on there being no news, was the Charlie Hebdo attack.
Right. Now that I do remember,
because
I can remember us all being in the office being like, what the hell? Joke, right?
Yeah.
We were
doing the Now Show at the time.
And
it was like, oh yeah, this is the one Now Show, because it's like still new. It was like... the first week of the year, we were going like, oh, right, yeah, we'll just do some jokes about, oh, New Year, let's just do some, like, light, soft topical stuff, and then that happened. Like,
You're so right. And I can remember Steve Punt in his intro threw in a Je suis Charlie.
Je suis Charlie's a very, oh, Steve, no, you're
a
not.
A real lump in the throat moment. I was like, yeah, we're all part of the same community. Yeah. I it's been much on my mind since we booked in this record. Obviously, I've been thinking about those times, and I just it's so funny how, what is it? I mean, we're like 8 years, you know, beyond that point now, and I still remember it as like, I genuinely think that job saved my life, you know, or certainly saved my ass. I mean, I was really on the verge of being like, it all, show business, for want of a better expression, all has to end. I can remember in 2012, New Year's Day 2012, I'd had to move back in with my mum in Plymouth.
Plymouth, mate.
Due to a breakup and things weren't going great. And New Year's Day saying to myself, if you don't sell a piece of writing this year, then it's not for you and you have to stop doing it. And that September, I got my first sketch on
Newsjack. And that was when I started getting on Newsjack as well. And we were in that writer's room, in that basement, eating jelly babies together.
And I think kind of going, oh my God, is it happening? Is this it just felt like such a free. Kurt Cobain once said, apparently, that the most exciting time to be in a band is right before it becomes your job.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel that, I mean, I love being a comedy writer, but I feel that a little bit about those days was that I still had an office job.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to pay my bills with comedy writing. It just felt like this great adventure where there was nothing bad about it.
And it was so exciting going into that little basement where there was never any sun in Grafton House. Because it was back in the days where you'd be so excited at like seeing a famous, just like walking past you, like, oh my God. Whereas these days we're like all sort of cynical and we're like, oh yeah, such and such in the toilet stall next to me, you know.
Exactly. I mean, I just got a kick out of getting a BBC pass. I remember the day we got our passes and I was like,
I still got mine. Oh my God,
the lanyard says BBC.
I know, I've still got mine in the bottom of my handbag. I used to use mine...
Basically to get into bars that I shouldn't get into at the Edinburgh Fringe. Because I'm not famous enough. Sure, so I just go, what about this pass?
Oh, it's a producer. And they'd go, still no.
You can get into the tent. They'll let you get into the tent if you've got your pass. But of course, the problem is that there's no expiry date on the pass, but there is one on my face. The march of time obviously makes them go... Are you still working, Granddad? that's the big problem.
I remember Ed's lanyard was like so young.
Do you remember he did this on our very first day?
Yeah, he took us out to lunch on our first day.
He just came up and went pub, and we went, oh my God. I mean, I was drunk.
Yeah.
That afternoon. Yeah. We went to a read through of a sitcom that didn't go, but it was full of famouses.
It was.
And I think you and I sat there half cut, and again, I was like, this can't be a job, can it?
Exactly. That was just the best. Yeah, you go there, you get given a laptop, and you get signed into your laptop, and then a really nice man who's made loads of really good comedy takes you to the pub, and then you sit pissed and listen to Reese Shearsmith read some lines. It's like, they're paying me for this. Insane.
If the Daily Mail hears this episode of your podcast, then we're going to go absolutely.
We've gone down memory lane a lot. That's going to be quite boring.
Again,
so we'll probably cut it.
I was going to say,
cut a lot.
It's going to be cut.
Let's move on and talk about your choices. Because we're here to talk about cartoons, not an office job we did 8 years ago.
It's a whole different podcast, like every other podcast.
So your first choice is a classic handsome hero who is practically perfect in every way, except for the tiny detail that, spoiler, he dies in the first act. He's a rare example of a fridged white male superhero. He's self-sacrificing and leaves a hero hole in the multiverse so big that it needs to be filled by several kids, a schlubby, broken 40-year-old version of himself, a pig, and Nicolas Cage. It's Miles' universe's blonde, blue-eyed Peter Parker from Into the Spider-Verse.
Yay!
So what is it about this guy? Because to be honest, when you told me, Peter Parker from In the Spider-Verse, but the Chris Pine version, I was like, Chris Pine was in it? And then I remember he's the really handsome classic guy who gets fridged like really, really early on.
Really,
And yeah, there's been so many cinematic Peter Parkers.
they really have. It's funny you say Chris Pine was in it, because I also think there's been, for as many cinematic Peter Parkers as there's been, there's also been many utterances of the phrase, wait, Chris Pine was in this? Like, we've discussed this before, but we know how hard it is to be a Hollywood Chris these days. Yeah. I mean, it feels like there's just, you know, they come off the factory floor thick and fast. I think if the Don't Worry Darling press tour in Venice taught us anything, is that I think we've only just scratched the surface of how good Chris Pine is.
Yes.
You know, he's good in a film, he's good being spat on by Harry Styles, if you believe it.
I watched Into the Spider-Verse, not really expecting very much from it at all. Immediately, I think within 5 minutes, being like, oh my God, I am completely in love with this film and so happy to be watching it. And then Chris Pine sort of, there's a montage, I think. Yes, so the movie starts with the voiceover of him saying this sort of classic line, okay, let's do this one last time.
All right, let's do this one last time. My name is Peter Parker. I was bitten by a radioactive spider. And for 10 years, I've been the one and only Spider-Man.
First of all, he loves being Spider-Man. Mm. And second of all, he's incredibly good at it. So there's this sort of montage of the fight scenes and then some very lovely sort of bits of fan service where we see him walking down the, doing his kind of Spider-Man 3 Tobey Maguire.
Yes, the Spider-Man 3 Tobey Maguire dance.
Which is a piece of cinema I think about pretty much every other day. Sometimes I'll just be changing my daughter's nappy and I'll be like, oh yeah, do you remember when Tobey Maguire danced down the road in Spider-Man 3? And that whole sequence ends with him hitting Mary Jane in the face. That happened in a film. So there's all of that, and then we go into Miles' story, and that's great, and you know, the voice cast are fantastic. It's beautifully animated.
It's gorgeous.
You know, it really is. And then, you know, we've done the spoilery stuff already, but yeah, so Miles gets bitten by a spider. He goes back to the scene of the biting, and it's just such a great piece of cinema because what it does is it takes Miles' very small world. You know, he's just a teenage guy, he's at school, he's got the usual teenage problems, and physically he's in this tiny little alleyway under the city in the subway, and suddenly the wall explodes and he and we as an audience are thrust into the hugeness of Chris Pine's Peter Parker Spider-Man world, and he's fighting with the Green Goblin, who in this iteration is this gigantic dragon-like creature, you know. And suddenly I was watching this movie and I was like, who is voicing this Spider-Man? Because he's fantastic. He's funny and he's quipping while he's being beaten up, which is obviously a very Spidey thing to do. Some great jokes. There's a line where he says Brooklyn can't be sucked into a super collider. You know, it's not zoned for that. Staten Island maybe, but not Brooklyn. And so you know, Miles gets pulled into this big fight and he rescues him, and it's just this wonderful moment where Peter, who's been Spider-Man for about 10 years, his spider sense tingles as he sees Miles and he says, you're like me. Mm. And he realizes that this person who's been alone and had to carry this burden has another. And as an audience, we go, oh, wow, great. So what's obviously going to happen is this very cool, lovely, handsome Peter Parker is going to take Miles under his wing. Oh, no, he's dead.
Yes.
And it's just a brilliant sort of rug pull in the movie, you know. It's the way Chris Pine embodies a version of Spider-Man, which I've sort of loved since I was a kid, that kind of made me, when his mask gets pulled off, I kind of go, oh yeah, I'd shag that kind of
thing. He's very much Peter at the top of his game, which I don't think we often see. So we see Peter as an awkward teenager a lot. That's how every one of his many, many films has started out. It's not often we see him as a grown ass man. So that's something that's quite nice about the things with Miles Morales in it. And it's the same with the game. I don't know if you played the Spider-Man game with the Miles.
I've not, but I have watched a little bit of the people playing it on YouTube because I don't have a console.
Oh,
but I'm such a Spider-Man nerd and a Batman nerd that I will watch people playing the game.
Yeah. The Miles extension pack of that game is, I enjoy it a lot more than the actual Spider-Man game. There's just more that Miles. There's more that Miles can do. I love going invisible and just like thwapping somebody, and then just like going invisible and like jumping up onto a roof and go hee hee, and then they can't see you. Whereas with Peter, if you thwap them, even if you jump on the roof, they're going, Hey, look, there's that guy in like bright red. Let's get him.
It's so lovely to have a Miles movie, you know, because there's been some talk about a live action version. And I think for a long time, Donald Glover was in the running, which would have been terrific. Mm. But again, I think it's what makes Spider-Verse, I think for me, like the best Spider-Man.
It is the best
movie,
Spider-Man. It's one of the best superhero films, in my opinion.
I really agree with you. I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that you've got this, everybody's journey is arced out really, really nicely. So you've got, as you say, this Peter who's at the top of his game. So what do we do with him? We've got to kill him. Mm. And then you've got this Miles who is, he's not quite, what's interesting about Miles is he's not sort of classic Peter. He's not really bullied.
Mm.
He's not like a nerd. Like, he's a good looking, charming kid who's quite funny, but he's being bussed to this sort of elite school, I guess.
Yeah, he's already out of his depth before he gets bitten by a spider. He feels very sort of, as you say, he's been bussed in. He is very, very intelligent, which is why he's got a scholarship to a fancy school. He's used to just like hanging out with his friends, and he's just like, he feels like he doesn't fit in already. And then he gets bitten by a spider and his hands go all sticky, and that makes things worse.
Oh, and that sequence is so great because the other thing it does brilliantly is that it goes from the animation changes to a more comic book style animation. Yes. So suddenly his thoughts go in bubbles where they didn't before, and it's panelled suddenly like a comic book. And I think those little details just make you go, I really don't think it puts a foot wrong. There's no fat on it. It doesn't drag for a second, that movie.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the, as you say, with his thoughts becoming bubbles and it becoming much more like a comic. And when you were saying about how when he's in the alley and then the world sort of explodes, the bit that always sort of, there's lots of bits that give me goosebumps in that film. And one of them is the bit where just before everything explodes, the word "watch out" flashes behind him in bright red. And that's the spider sense working for the first time.
Exactly.
Then everything behind him explodes, which is amazing. I mean, obviously, the other goosebumps moment is "What's Up, Danger," where he jumps off the he leaps for the first time, and they flip it upside down, and he's falling upwards, and that's a beautiful moment.
And again, it's in terms of story, all of that kind of coming back around again. I have a real goosebump moment when the Peter that I find very attractive. Mm-hmm. Is covered in rubble, and I think there's a sort of it's writing that I'm always trying to achieve, and is somehow always sort of slightly out of reach, where you kind of catch your breath and go, "Oh, this thing is about to happen."
Yeah,
you know, you sort of you're the last one in the room.
Yeah,
and then it does, and so what's really goosebumpy for me is that Miles has to get all of his like mental shit done in about 2 minutes.
Yes.
From this guy who's dying.
Yes.
And again, it's just, and then what's great about that is that then when Schlubby Peter appears, it's like the reward is great because you go, oh no, and now you've got this like consolation prize.
Yes.
Mental.
So Peter from Miles's universe is great. I am all about Peter B. Parker. I love a broken man. And people who've listened to this podcast will know about my thing for broken men. And he's so broken. I don't think he's got a top on. He's just got like some jogging bottoms on and no shoes.
Yeah, he's half Spider-Man, half
hobo.
Since my daughter was born. Yeah, exactly. It's such a, I mean, first of all, we should say that he's voiced by Jake Johnson from New Girl and Jurassic Park, and I think that is like half the ball game right there, because he's such a funny actor, he's such a charming actor. And as you say, you know, he rocks up in this. I think he's got like a brown trench coat on. And he's definitely got a belly. I think that's the thing that I really like about
him. Yeah, he's got a beer belly, beer and pizza belly. And I love him.
And then he's sort of... So then Miles gets this kind of... I think he describes him, he says, you know, why didn't I get this broke-ass Spider-Man?
Yeah.
And it's just the second act just kicks in, and you have this great, odd couple. You know, he's a reluctant mentor, whereas I sort of get the impression that had Chris Pine's
lovely sex with Spider-Man
lived, he'd have lived for it, because I think he's lonely. There's the thing about Spider-Man that I kind of feel like the other movies never quite got, and certainly not the Marvel one, which is excellent, is that it's quite lonely to be Spider-Man. Yeah. It's quite lonely to be Peter Parker. Batman gets a Robin. Spider-Man doesn't really get anybody. Loads of people die, you know, it seems. And he's, I remember somebody saying to me once, Superman can take a lump of coal in the palm of his hand and turn it into a diamond. Spidey is always broke.
Yes.
And I really respond to that. I think, especially when I was younger, this guy who, he's got all of these powers, but it's very difficult to monetize them. Print media is his only...
really is. There's a delightful... I think it's a canon thing that I saw ages ago. I think it's canon rather than fan art, but it was was Tony Stark trying to put an Avengers team together, and he goes to Wolverine and says, "We've got beer," and Wolverine's like, "Fine." He goes to Spider-Man and says, "We'll pay you." And Spider-Man says, "Oh, thank you. Thank God."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's kind of what's great about that sort of the Civil War Homecoming era. I should point out, by the way, I do also love the Tom Holland.
Yeah, he's really good.
I do think, as movies, I think they're great.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy the idea that he's an intern, because that felt very...
Yes.
That felt very much of the time, you know. So he's got this, you know, he's got Peter B. Parker, who is himself contending with things, because it's basically he's broke.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Jane has left him because he doesn't want kids, because he's, again, scared of endangering them. Aunt May's died. Sorry, guys. Spoiler. And as you say, he's kind of he really is the opposite of Chris Pine, Peter Parker, isn't he?
I mean, they're both teaching each other to be Spider-Man.
Exactly.
Which I love. And then you've got all the rest of the Spider-Verse who show up, and they're so much fun. I mean, that film is not scared to go absolutely batshit. Getting Nicolas Cage to play noir Spider-Man who can't see colours because he's always in black and white. And then Spider-Ham is just really good fun. And
you've
got an anime Spider-Girl. It's brilliant. And Gwen, who's delightful.
And who is the I've forgotten her name? Is it Penny? Penny Parker.
Penny Parker, the anime Spider Girl.
From the future. Yes. The anime Spider Girl. Yeah, who again is just fantastic. And I feel like each of those characters, every time I watch it, and I've seen it quite a lot, I always kind of go, "Oh, God bless you, Nicolas Cage, for like you really showed up for this."
Yeah.
You know, like he approaches it like someone who's maybe done two movies before.
Yes.
His energy and commitment to it. And the same with Mulaney, who I'm a big fan of in pretty much all of his iterations, is just kind of perfect for it, because that, you know, Mulaney loves that kind of 1940s kind of era.
He's got the right voice for it, hasn't he? Absolutely got just a classic. Warner Brothers Looney Tunes voice.
And there's a great line at the end when he's about to go back to his universe where he's, "Take this giant mallet, it'll fit in your pocket."
it's weeping.
Details. Yeah, exactly. And I think he says that's all, folks, as he goes into the voice cast is
the voice cast's amazing.
So many good people.
Yes. Well, let's move on to your second choice. So your second choice is not just sexy. She is, in my opinion, the only objectively sexy character in a show that is entirely about sex. She's got magic hair, hooves that won't quit, and smells amazing because of all those bubble bears. She's an immortal being in charge of overseeing puberty, but she will absolutely stop from time to time to have an affair with other immortal beings. If you're on the blob, it's probably her fault. It's Connie Lasienga, the hormone monstrous from Big Mouth. Oh man, as soon as you said Connie, I was like, yes. Yes, that's the good shit. She is so attractive.
Oh my god, she really is. I'm surprised that I didn't think of her originally, because I had put a couple of other choices that really I just felt I probably couldn't talk as passionately about as this character in this show. And then when I hit upon Connie, I'm so dumb. I mean, first of all, I'm currently watching series 6, so it's like it's on my mind. and I genuinely do find this character sexually
attractive. He is so sexy. It's like none of the other... I don't find any of the other hormone monsters attractive at all. Like, I think the male ones are drawn sort of very much with a sort of male point of view, and they're all quite in a sort of gross. Like, even Maury, who's the main one, is, like, kind of gross. But the other... There's another female hormone monster, and she's not as sexy as Connie. There's something about Connie that's just... gorgeous. I mean, she's voiced by Maya Rudolph.
A bit like the Jake Johnson, Peter Parker thing. That is, you know, you're 50% there.
You are. She's like, so funny, and she's so talented with her voice and the things that she can do with her voice anyway. And yeah, she's sort of got this sort of Midwest kind of drawl, but also, yeah, she pronounces words in a funny way, and... Oh, it's just, and yeah, a bubble bear.
It's, which, I mean, it really does. I hadn't thought of that sort of Midwestern thing, but you're right. It's almost Scarlett O'Hara meets Tina Turner, you know? There's a kind of a, like, I mean, she's very curvy. I think that there's the voice, and then there's the physicalization, and then the third arm, I think, is, well, all of it really, but the emotional side of it. But to talk about how she looks, like you were saying about the hair, I think I watched the episode she first appears in, which I think is the second one of the first series, and yeah, you know, it's like Doc Ock, you know, the hair. She pulls Jesse into her and wraps her around, and it's like they're extensions of her hands. Yes. You know, and then she steps back so we can take in all of her, and she's just got these incredible curves and
her fur kind of looks like she's wearing low riding kickflare jeans, and then like a top that's tied under the boobs. So she's even got a sort of cowgirl, sort of Dixie Chicks kind of look to her, but with fur instead of denim and plaid.
And those big blue eyes. Ugh. And the only thing that does give me pause for thought is that her mouth does remind me of Zippy's from Rainbow.
It's a very big mouth. And then I think to myself,
it's a big mouth in a big mouth, isn't it?
The show is called Big Mouth. That's I think that's mostly Nick Kroll being self-deprecating, but everyone's got a really big mouth in that show.
Well, it's a funny thing. It's one of the, I mean, I love Big Mouth. I genuinely have so much love for it. Mm. And it's a rare example of finding a show that hadn't been recommended to me, which is so much, I think, of TV, isn't it? Yeah. That's kind of, you've got
to
watch this.
You recommended it to me. You told me to watch it. Yes, you did.
I think I was shouting it from the rooftops after the first series.
You were really excited to find it.
Yeah, because I'm very rarely a tastemaker. Mm. You know, I'm very often the kind of, I always sort of say, you know, I didn't grow up as a comedy nerd particularly. Mm. So I'm always kind of the guy, so a bit like Joey and Friends, being like, oh, what's that? Okay, Round the Horn? Cool, okay. And so having found it, it's a bit like getting into a band that nobody else has heard of yet. It was me and Ed Amsden of Amsden and Cole's writing partnership fame. We both sort of discovered at the same time, and we would message each other being like, have you seen this? Have you seen that? Yeah. You know, what about this? What about that? I was aware of Nick Kroll. I didn't watch Kroll's show, so I wasn't hugely aware of who he was, but I just think he's created this show that somehow is able to be really dirty and filthy, you know, in that kind of South Park way.
Mm.
And yet is a sort of like a vessel for all of this sex positivity. And a bit like series two of Sex Education, and presumably series three, I've not watched it. You can sort of use it as if you were a teenager going through puberty, you could kind of use it as a manual, because it's all positive.
Yeah. It's,
there's no judgment.
Yeah, it is very, very good in that way. And it's not just about sex either. It is about all the shit. They're going through changes, as the song says. It's about all of the changes that puberty can bring. You know, the good and the bad and the sexy and the gross and the sad and the things that are still taboo that we're not allowed to, that we're certainly not supposed to talk about with children, with sadness and depression and loneliness. And there's queer characters who feel lonely because they feel like they're the only, you know, there's Matthew who feels like he's the only queer kid in school. It turns out he's not. And yeah, just, I mean, there's obviously all the stuff that Jessie goes through. Jessie goes through an incredibly hard time, and I still don't think she's entirely out of that hard time.
No, she really isn't. And it's funny, I was trying to think of the character that I most associate with, and I think it is Jessie. Like, my parents got divorced, and so I think, and also just her sensibilities, you know, the way that she can be very kind and a good friend, but can also be very selfish and very and a bad friend. Yeah. And I sort of look back on my teenage years and go, oh yeah, that was you. You know, you were, you know, you really let people down sometimes as well as the times that you didn't. And again, I think for an animated comedy to have, for those characters to be so, no pun intended, so well drawn, like, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Matthew actually, because watching an episode from season one over the weekend in preparation for this, you know, we were saying how Andrew, the Mulaney voiced character, is not very nice. I've realised that he's much nicer in the early series, and he's getting nastier in that way that a person can do.
Yes. So a lot of the characters have got growth. A lot of, like, Matthew's got loads of growth. Jay's got loads of growth. He's, you know, Jay's coming from a horrific background and is going through lots of growth. And the Nick Kroll character is. And the only one who seems to be going through, like, backwards growth is Andrew Glauberman, who's, yes, as you say, he starts off, he's kind of sex mad, but he's mostly nice and a good friend, and he just becomes a horrible toxic sort of beater. You know, he's got that sort of toxic beater thing going on. He's like, oh, poor me, I'm a nerd, but he's also just gross to girls. And to be fair, it never applauds him for that. It never applauds him for being a gross boy and for being horrible to girls, and for feeling like he deserves a girlfriend.
No, you're quite right. And I think it digs into, especially in the later series, you know, when you start seeing his home life a bit more, he has this very unpleasant father, which is so funny because
he's played by Richard Kind, the nicest man in showbiz.
Kind by nature. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For anyone who has seen Spin City, which I hope is everybody, like, you know, I can't think of a nicer guy to play this utter. Again, I mean, like, talking about, I think the other thing that's great about the show, apart from the fact that it's very joke focused in that way that US sitcoms are so good at, because you can pay for a writer's room.
Imagine.
What Kroll has done brilliantly is he's gone, oh, what if I just at least offered it out to the absolute best people in comedy? I mean, the cast is just completely insane.
Yeah.
Supporting and main.
I mean, they've got Jordan Peele in it, who's still in, like, the main credits, and he just plays a ghost who very occasionally turns up. Like, I think the ghost only turns up about twice a series, going, hey, hey, hey.
Imagine if it was the 80s and Transformers had Martin Scorsese voicing one of the robots. Because that is the closest. Jordan Peele is now this incredibly lauded movie director.
He just occasionally turns up as a ghost. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's a very, and he's got a lovely kind of sing song. He can say the most awful thing, but say it. I'm just having a sort of a little scan down the list now, but yeah, you know, and also they did what The Simpsons should have done sooner and didn't, which is that, in the first four seasons, I think, Missy, who is African-American.
Yes.
Is voiced by a white actress, very talented white actress, Jenny Slate, who was on SNL. She's great. And I don't know if there was internet talk or if the show just decided to do the right thing. And they recast her with, I can't pronounce her name, Ayo Edebiri, I think she's called.
Yeah.
Who is also currently in The Bear, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and it was in that series that they sort of do more stuff with Missy feeling like she doesn't belong because she's mixed race. She feels like she doesn't quite. She's also a massive nerd. I love Missy. I think Missy might be my favorite.
Yeah, me too.
Well,
it's funny you say that, Gabby, because whenever it goes into the Nathan Fillion stuff, I always
think of me.
Even though we've never talked about it, I'm like, I'll bet all the money in my pockets that Gabby's got the hearts for Nathan Fillion.
I kind of do. I mean, not as much as I do sort of other sadder, more broken looking men, but yeah, he's classically handsome. Oh, Nathan Fillion. I do.
He's too happy for you, isn't he? That's the problem. Yeah. Nathan Fillion's too well adjusted.
Exactly.
Let's wait 10 years when the wheels fall off.
Yeah. I like men who look like they'd settle. who look like they have very low self-esteem.
I my wife is the exception to this rule, but I like women who I think will make me really unhappy. I would probably date Lola if I was dating anybody in that show, just because she's so awful.
I mean, Connie might make you unhappy because Connie can't really help it, because she's just the monster of hormones. So just getting back to Connie, I think one of the things that I do really like about her is that because she is primarily Jesse's hormone monster, she's with Jesse a lot of the time, and Jesse just goes through such bad shit and is often... Because her friends have all got their own drama going on, they often ignore her. She's just sort of left with Connie as her only companion, really. And so Connie cares deeply about Jesse. And I think Connie shares a lot of her vulnerabilities. And so we see Connie in a way that we don't see the other hormone monsters, showing vulnerability. She gets sad for Jesse. She gets worried for Jesse when Jesse basically becomes severely mentally ill. Connie gets really, really worried.
I want to go with Kitty.
What? No!
Kitty's right. I am so tired of fighting and feeling bad.
Oh, no! I can help you.
No, you just make things worse.
I've got it from here, love.
She just seems, as well as having this incredible confidence, I think it's the confidence that's the most sexy thing about Connie.
Yeah.
But she's also got this very sweet and caring side to her. And she just seems really well-rounded in a way that a lot of the other hormone monsters, including possibly Maury, just don't have, even though Maury's like the main hormone monster.
I totally agree with you. And one of the things that I like maybe the thing I like the most about the hormone monsters is they're simultaneously... they're guides, so they have knowledge, but they are also as naive as the humans that they're in charge of. So there are so many times when, if there's a great episode in season six, spoiler alert, it's not really a spoiler alert, it's just a story plot, where Jessie gets a yeast infection and she's in the bathroom using all of these products that she's shoplifted from the pharmacy, and she's freaking out, and Connie picks up on that energy and she freaks out and she uses one of her brilliant malapropisms where she says,
zhuzhul it.
Yeast infection. And I love it when, if Jessie's crying, that suddenly Connie starts crying. There's a great line in her first appearance where she says, now fling yourself on the bed and cry until no sound comes out. And I'm just like, oh, a lovely, lovely bit of business.
I just really love her. She's gorgeous.
She is the best. She's just fucking hot. Man.
She is just fucking hot. That's all I can say. Nothing we can do about it. Let's move on to your third choice, who is possibly like the opposite. But they're both ginger, so that's what links them. So your third choice is technically a secretary, but let's face it, she's essentially an office manager, administrator, and part-time exorcist. She's got a Brooklyn accent, horn-rimmed glasses, an almighty nerd crush, and she deserves better. From the real Ghostbusters and Extreme Ghostbusters, it's Janine Melnitz.
Woo!
I really loved Janine when I was a kid, but... she deserved better, and also it meant that I deserved better, because I tried playing Ghostbusters in the playground with my friends once, because it had been primary school. I was a kind of a nerd and I would hang out with the boys who watched, like, because I liked Ghostbusters and Thundercats and all that shit. I'd hang out with the boys who also liked that shit. And if we were playing Thundercats, I was in for a good time because I could be Chitara and I could just run around. If we were playing Ghostbusters, I was in for the most boring playtime, because what would happen if we were playing Ghostbusters is I would sit and pretend to type at an imaginary desk for 15 minutes. And that was my playtime. So you
would be getting up from a school desk as the playtime bell rang, walking out onto the playground,
and pretending
sitting
to
down
do
at
admin.
Your imaginary desk.
Sitting down at an imaginary desk and pretending to do admin while my friends ran around and pretended plus ghosts.
That's so funny. Yeah. I mean, that is the thing. I, it, it's, I loved the real Ghostbusters. I do feel like we grew up, growing up in the 80s and 90s, maybe everybody feels like this, but it felt like a halcyon time. Thundercats, Transformers, City of Gold, yeah, Dungeons and Dragons.
They were a bit shit.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I was a bit on the fence about Janine, because I did watch an episode, you know, a couple of episodes on YouTube, and I was like, it's got its heart's in the right place in some episodes, you know, like it's trying.
Yeah.
To give her a bit more to do. Sometimes they let her strap on a proton pack, but unfortunately, the bulk of her job is either doing admin or occasionally she plans birthday parties.
Look at my desk. Ooh, that genie.
He won't trouble you again.
Egon, don't you think I'm beautiful when I'm mad?
I think the strain is getting to her.
Janine, you showed a lot of guts today.
Yeah, and we'd be proud to have you as a full-fledged Ghostbuster.
Yeah. Slimer, no kissing. But thanks. Thanks a lot, guys. But I've decided to stick with my old job.
Huh?
What the?
I think I'll be a lot happier leaving the Ghostbusting to the Ghostbusters.
The caring role.
Yeah.
You know, she's one of her sort of secretary mum, isn't she?
And what's also perhaps a little disappointing, first of all, what I will say is I don't think Ghostbusters is a movie. I love Ghostbusters and I loved it as a kid. But again, it's movies that we were allowed to watch as children and movies that were almost sort of geared to us now seem very weird. Mm. I mean, Ghostbusters is essentially the story of three disgraced professors who start a small business and break every environmental regulation in the city of New York.
And do a lot of sexual harassment.
Oh, my God. Scene with the cards.
Oh, there's
so
much sexual harassment that they do.
Yeah. And I'm afraid to say the majority of it is coming from everybody's favourite comedian, Bill Murray. There's a scene where the Slimer scene when they go to the hotel.
Yeah.
They walk through the front door and he kind of bothers a woman who's walking past him. It's a tiny little moment, but you kind of go, this isn't great.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't know why people keep trying to make Ghostbusters happen, because I think it's probably better to just go, this first movie's really good.
Yeah.
And none of the other iterations. And I'm even talking about Ghostbusters 2 here, which I'm,
Ghostbusters 2 is dog shit.
It's a bad movie, right?
It's
a good
movie. It's like I kind of enjoyed the Lady Ghostbusters one. I enjoyed that one, but everyone was saying that's ruined Ghostbusters. No, it hasn't. Ghostbusters 2 ruined Ghostbusters because Ghostbusters 2 is a dog shit movie.
Yeah. I always found it crazy when people on Twitter were going like, this old Lady Ghostbusters has ruined my childhood. And I was like, no, it hasn't. It's our parents that ruin our childhood. Come on, guys. But this, the real Ghostbusters, when I was a kid, was just fantastic.
Yeah, it was.
And I really, and you know, I mean, I must have been about 12, I think, when it came out. And I definitely, there's a scene in the opening credits where the phone rings, Janine picks it up, and she just looks fantastic. You know, she's got this red hair and this
with
bright
specs.
Pink lipstick. And the specs, which apparently were designed specifically to not seem too harsh for children.
All right.
She's got more kind of like Michael Caine, Ipcris file glasses in the movie.
Ah, right.
And apparently, I only know this getting ready for the podcast. I didn't know this at 12. What a weird kid I would have been. They really kind of softened her because they were worried that the movie iteration that Annie Potts played her, who's a terrific actress, was going to be too harsh.
Right.
Which in itself is kind of sexist, isn't
it? That's very sexist.
This woman who doesn't give a shit might be off-putting to small boys. But what I will say is I did find the cartoon version of Janine extremely attractive. So
I didn't find her attractive, but I rooted for her like anyone's business, because what they do in the cartoon is they take that hint that Janine fancies Egon that's in the first film, that again goes out the window in Ghostbusters 2. In Ghostbusters 2, she just goes off and has sex with Rick Moranis, which is fair enough, because Rick Moranis is hot. In the cartoon, they like make that like a proper, like she is properly in love with him, and that's probably why she's sticking at this kind of shitty job where she gets treated as a secretary mommy. Yeah, I really like a character who knows what she wants, and what she wants is just that sweet, sweet nerd dick. And I think that's absolutely fair enough. That's a goal that she wants, and she's gonna and she also gets paid while trying to get it. So I think that's fair enough. So I really rooted for her. I know what it's like to have a weird ass crush. To be honest, I find Egon quite attractive as well in like cinematic and cartoon form. With the walnut whip hair that he's got, lovely ice cream.
His hair's incredible in the cartoon version, because everybody else is kind of like
the same.
It's kind of the same. You know, they switch up the uniforms, but for some reason they've just got, let's give Egon totally crazy, as you say, like Mr. Whippy ice cream hair, but he looks great. I mean, he does. He's like, now he would be living in Hackney and driving a penny farthing around.
Yes!
He was ahead of his time.
He was. Yeah, there's been quite a lot of lovelorn characters so far in this series. Because even some of the women were like choosing some of the women in the first series were choosing some men who were quite lovelorn. We've had some fellas who've chosen sort of lovelorn female characters. So and maybe that's just a comedy thing. Maybe we're all of us people in comedy, certainly in comedy writing, know that we're some kind of that kind of person, person who just sits there in a corner like a goblin, just. yearning for someone much prettier.
Oh my god, and that was my entire childhood. I was very lovelorn. I would always be in love with babysitters and teachers and girls from school. I also think just from like a writing perspective, whenever I'm writing, you know, kind of a sitcom or a film or whatever it is I'm writing at the time, there's always a romance in there. I think especially in sitcom, if you're writing something that is supposed to be continuing.
Yeah.
It's a great way to
get people hooked the will they won't they, or if they have, can they keep this going? And it's always like a romance, especially like a yearning romance, is always a brilliant hook for me. That is a great way to keep me watching.
You just don't have to sell the idea of unrequited love. I think that's the thing. We've all experienced it at some point, you know. And so it's a great, and maybe that's what Janine kind of does in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And also she's just got absolutely fantastic legs.
She does have fantastic legs.
she's drawn quite triangularly, if that's a word.
There's a lot of spikes to her.
Yes, exactly. The glasses and the way that her fringe falls over her face, the shape of her chin. My image of her in my head, even though it's probably not in the TV show that much, is that she's often sitting at a desk with her legs sort of in that knees together sideways, and that creates a triangle.
Yes,
I'm sure all of that is intentional.
Yes, yeah. Brilliant. I will end it with one last question for you, which is that if you were able to take one of these cartoon characters out of cartoons and make them a flesh and blood person in the real world, who would you choose and would you try to romantically pursue them?
Oh, what a good question. I mean, I think Connie would be a very dangerous real life entity because, I mean, hot as she is a monster. I worry that she might kill everyone. And I don't want to date Spider-Man because you tend to end up dead yourself, don't you?
Yes.
But I probably would actively pursue Janine because she does occasionally strap on the proton pack. And so I would be dating a Ghostbuster, which means I would get to hang out with 1980s Sigourney Weaver. We'd get a lunch. And I'd be up for that.
Yeah, is an excellent choice. Thank you. Okay. Before you go, have you got any projects that you want to talk about?
We'll be doing the new series of Comic Relief, which will be coming out, as always, March and April. So please do give generously. We're hoping to have a bit more of a kind of focus on climate change. I'm not an official spokesperson for the charity, but I'm hoping that that's going to be something that we can fold into everything else. So as always, please watch and give generously.
Please watch and donate because it all goes for a good cause. Thank you so much, Max.
Huge thanks to Max Davis. For more credits and details, see @curiously_drawn on Twitter.